Everybody sounds kind of low energy this morning. I know I am.
It's because it's 10 o'clock in the morning.
What I wanted to talk about, let's see how it goes, is how because of the pandemic and because we're seeing more and more catalog titles, and some of them are being converted to 4K HDR, what impact that's having on us reviewing stuff. Mainly because I've had a number of experiences now looking at stuff in HD and then looking at it and sort of wondering what it would be like in 4K. Mm-hmm. And it's a chance to also talk about some of the stuff we've chosen for the essentials, because some of these have been extraordinary and some older films just don't hold up.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little wacky as we move fully into this new era where, you know, now all of the big shiny new things have sort of gotten their releases, and there haven't been shiny new things recently. So all of the studios are finally dipping deep into the catalog, but 4K HDR is revealing, and that can be a very good thing and it can be a very bad thing. You know, I talked about in my review of the Blues Brothers, what a sort of mess the extended edition is in terms of sources. You know, it's like they're pulling from the negative in some spots, and, you know, a print for the Roadshow in another spot, and the print for the premiere in another spot. And, well, maybe you could kind of see the difference between those sources on DVD. Not really. Oh, you could kind of, yeah, oh yeah, you could see them on HD. Wow, that doesn't look as good as that. And then you move to 4K and it's like suddenly passages of the film just become unwatchable, you know, because of just how disparate the quality of the elements is. So
I think you also see, like, you know, in the two that I saw recently, My Fair Lady and Spartacus, the effort they're willing to put into what they consider to be like really marquee titles, and, you know, what kind of elements they can get their hands on and how much money they're willing to invest in them. Mm-hmm. You know, not every title is going to merit, you know, 9 months of it restoration work and, you know, millions of dollars put into it. But I think, you know, like anything, if they think they can get their money back out of it, the return on investment, I think we'll continue seeing it when they feel like it can pay off for them. They, Hollywood.
Yeah, were both of those larger format films?
I believe that they both were. Yeah. You would know, Mike, film historian that you are, but I think that they were.
Well, I'm just putting that out there because I think that's having a big impact on it. All the films we've got on the list are either more recent or they were large format to begin with. Like 2001 was a Cinerama release shot in 70 millimeter. So
yes.
The only one I'm thinking of that doesn't quite fit that is The Shining, because it was definitely 35 millimeter. But that was 1980, so it was a little later than these others.
I know that Warner Brothers just announced a slate of things that they were going to redo, and one of those is Willy Wonka. And yep. I can't imagine that was a large format film or really a high budget movie at the time. I mean, so it'll be interesting to see what kind of elements they can pull for that.
Well, John, like I mentioned when you and I were talking about it last week, is that it's going to be interesting to see how that fares, because that was never a particularly good looking movie to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping they can pull out a lot of vibrant colors, you know, when they go into the chocolate factory, and, you know, but again, I could see where it could really lay bare some of the makeup work and, you know, some of the
effect shots. There's some terrible process work in that film.
Yeah, like, you know, Mike TV, but, you know, how is the scene when they go into, you know, Willy Wonka's, that the opening part when they go into the chocolate factory? Well, that just looks so fake now, or, you know, but I think that's part of the nostalgia of old movies, is you kind of get what you get and, you know, take what you had at the time.
Yeah, but try to think of a good analogy for this, and this isn't it, but it's like going to hear like a brilliant pianist do the Goldberg Variations, but the piano's out of tune and half the keys are missing with some of these releases. My point being, it's hard to ignore it.
Yeah.
You know, you try to get into the film, but then there are certain technical things that just pull you out.
Yeah. But you know, it's a two-sided coin. When it does work, it draws you in a way mm-hmm. that it's never been possible before at home.
Yeah, it's kind of painful. I mean, the thing I'm going through with Chinatown now, which I'm writing up, is, boy, I love seeing it in 4K. But I just can't believe the disparity from shot to shot and shot in that film. And that is not how they originally released it. So I'm wondering what went wrong.
Yeah.
You know, some of it looks like hand-tinted postcards and some of it's spot on.
And you and I talked about it, Mike. I mean, to me, the thing that I really noticed, like, again, it was my first viewing of Spartacus, but I really noticed how whenever they had shots with the main actress in it, that they were so defocused that I don't think that's people viewing it at the theater at the time would have been so aware of that. But watching, you know, you go from these scenes that are just razor sharp, you know, ultra detail to, you know, it looks like you rolled back to almost VHS level sharpness. It's glaring in how it stands out. But obviously that was just the filming style of the time.
Yeah. Sorry.
I was going to say, and that, you know, that was something that really jumped out at me.
Right. And I could be completely off base about this, but I think this is one of the continual problems because it comes up with process shots, comes up with photo backdrops in movies, and it comes up with stuff like that. They knew that they were shooting film to be shown on a big screen where it was going to be reflected light and running through a film gate. And I think they allowed for that. And it was never meant to be essentially frozen the way that it's the same thing with title sequences. Title sequences were meant to have the feel of going through a film gate. And when they just look like slideshows now, there's just something really off-putting about that. And I don't know if there's a good way to compensate for it when you're doing transfers.
Yeah, that's a good point. Tsiaka, I noticed that as well with It's a Wonderful Life. Like every shot of Donna Reed in that movie looks like they just basically took a tub of Vaseline and smeared the lens before they shot her. So really, really stood out. But it, you know, again, it really, really stood out in contrast with the sharpness and the detail of every shot that didn't have her in it. So
yeah. And again, you're limited with the source material and the filming style of the day. But I think that those are the kinds of things that really stand out when you're watching them. And, you know, to your point, Mike, of things that can pull you out of it. I was constantly aware that I was watching a movie every time it cut to her and it was got so soft because you couldn't help but notice it. But again, it's, you know, you're watching a movie that's in that case, what, 60 some years old, and it still looks better than you'd ever seen it. So I guess yeah. You put up with it.
Well, and also, you know, at the time, let's face it, there probably weren't video files when It's a Wonderful Life was released. So it's, you know, a lot of it is just norms and cultural expectations. I mean, these days we expect when there's a close up on an actor that it's going to be sharp and it's going to be, you know, stubbles and hairs and pores. And, you know, back then I think there was just a sort of expectation that, well, you know, when the leading lady's on the screen, it's going to be all glowy and dewy and a dreamlike, you know? So I'm not saying that's the entirety of it, but I'm saying, you know, the expectations do play into it a little bit. I mean, because, hey, let's face it, that's all audiences had known to that point. So while I do agree with Mike that a lot of it has to do with, yes, the fact that that's, you know, audiences in the day weren't watching literally the most primitive element the way we were. They were watching a second generation element. But yes, also there was the whole projection thing and everything like that. And I agree that is a consideration, but I think expectations also.
Yeah. I was also going to say, I don't think back then, you know, today when they are making a movie, they're as much thinking about the home release.
Yeah.
You know, it's like today, you know, for a lot of movies, that's where they make their money up and that's where they live forever is on the home release. You know, back then there was really no such thing as a home theater there. I mean, certainly were screening rooms, I'm guessing, in people's homes. But, you know, the idea was we're making it for the big screen. That's where it's only going to ever be seen. And, you know, that's where it needs to look, you know. But today things are being shot with the home release in mind. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's definitely, it speaks to the style of you know, filming and maybe choices taken in the creative process.
Yeah, movies definitely were not made to be watched, you know, over and over and over back in the day, certainly.
Sorry, sipping some coffee.
Yeah, me too.
It's weird. We're kind of doing a thing where when you watch stuff in the theaters, you allow for certain things. You know, you get used to certain conventions, but now we're having to compensate the other direction, mm-hmm. where we can see too much. And we sort of have to allow for it as we're watching the films. And the other variable is in the past year, we're getting to the point where the majority of people are going to have screens 75 inches and bigger. Whether or not their homes are big enough to really allow for that isn't the point. Everybody wants one and they're becoming affordable.
Yeah.
So now everything is going to go under this incredible scrutiny. And we're going to get into the thing of, and the other thing is, people are going to have good enough playback by default now. Whereas it used to be people would have a big screen and they have a lousy feed and it would just look terrible, and yet they lived with it. But now everybody's going to have razor sharp playback from a variety of services. Mm-hmm. And it's going to make it more interesting to be reviewing this stuff going forward. Yeah. You know, but how many times can we point that out before it gets redundant?
Well, you know, and also we have to sort of keep in mind, are people really paying attention to this stuff? You know, it's all, I often find when I'm watching movies with my friends who aren't necessarily cinephiles, certainly not videophiles, there are just things that completely fly over their radar. I'll notice something and I don't know, make a comment about it after the film, and you know, commenting on the fact of, oh boy, that those effects didn't hold up, did they? And, you know, and it's just like, it's lost on a lot of my normie friends. It's certainly lost on my wife, you know, for the most part. She just doesn't pay attention to the same things that I do. And I'm not saying she's not paying attention to the film, not paying attention to the experience. She's just paying attention to different things. So, again, that's something we have to keep in mind too, I think.
Sometimes ignorance is bliss. To just be able to sit back and enjoy it and not be, you know, it's like distracted by banding or, you know, whatever else. I mean, sometimes it is the less you know, sometimes you can't, you are unencumbered by that technical knowledge. And so, you know, sometimes maybe it's for the best.
But, yeah. You know, at the same time, I think there's a subconscious realization of it. Even if it's not conscious, you know, I mean, I think if you're watching something and there is egregious banding and black crush and things like that, I do think that puts up something of a screen between the viewer and what is being viewed, whether or not they could articulate it or not.
But I guess the question is, why then are people actively coveting 75 inches or bigger? You know, want a more immersive experience. I mean, It's got to be a perceptual shift to go from 42 inches to 75 or larger.
Yeah.
You know, especially in a room that's too small and you're almost on top of the damn screen.
Well, I think that a lot of the consumer perception is that everything is going to look reference quality. You know, it's like everything that I see is going to be perfect. When they're buying a TV, because, you know, being one of the only people here that actually sells TVs to people, still people want to come in and they'll ask us, how can I hook up my VCR to this? And I'm like, well, you can, but it's going to look terrible. I mean, understand, you know, that you're taking something that was never meant to be shown this big or with this many pixels. So yes, you can do it, but it's going to look awful. But you know, the people's idea is that everything is going to look 4K and beautiful and glorious. And so I think that's why everybody wants to get the biggest screen possible, because they imagine everything's going to look great.
I could be wrong, but I would think most of them are watching a lot of network TV and cable channels and older content that's got to look abysmal on those screens.
Well, you know, I think I told you this, Mike. You know, I'm sharing one of my favorite Canadian TV shows with my wife right now, Corner Gas. And the first two seasons are only available in 4x3, 480i. And it's just kind of hard to watch, man.
Yeah.
I'm like sitting here waiting for season three to come when they switch over to high def, you know. But, you know, it's funny. It doesn't really seem to affect her at all. But, you know, getting back to the question you asked of you know, everybody having 75 inch TVs, I think we also have to, you know, we have to accept that there's a bit of an arms race going on here. You know, my friends all drive Porsches, I must make amends. Well, Bob down the street got a 75 inch TV, so I've got to get an 85 inch TV, you know, and sometimes it's just a status symbol. So
the question is, what pertains for the majority of people? Essentially, that thing is going to take over whatever room it's in. It can't be secondary anymore. And I've seen most of these, like I said, I can look up my apartment building at buildings literally three blocks away and see what people are watching on their TVs. And these are not massive apartments, mm-hmm. but they're massive TVs.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, you know, again, you're living in New York where Dennis and I are. I'm going to guess where Dennis is. I mean, houses are much more, probably larger, bigger rooms, you know, spread out. I mean, when we do an install in a great room here, I mean, it is a great room with, you know, a wall that could easily support a 100 inch screen.
Yeah.
You know, if the person so desired. I mean, and very rarely anymore is the screen too large for the viewing distance.
Yeah.
I mean, it can certainly be too large for the room and just physically look out of place. But I mean, when you talk about, you know, exceeding a subtended viewing angle and it being just physically too large for the seating, that very rarely do we run into that.
Yeah, it's same here. You know, my friends who have 65-inch TVs, I feel like I need opera glasses to watch them. You know?
Yeah.
Because they're way over there.
when I started at Custom Theater and Audio, it was in 1998, and a 27 or 32-inch TV was a big bedroom TV. And now, I mean, we're routinely putting 65s in bedrooms because, you know, walls are getting bigger, beds are further back, you know, and it's not the price is no longer a barrier to having it. So why not, you know, if you're going to enjoy a TV, why not actually get one that you can enjoy the size of? And what that also does, though, is it pushes the need for a larger TV in your primary viewing location, because who wants to go into the bedroom for the biggest TV in the house? I mean, you want to go, you know, so it kind of is, you know, I'm putting something bigger in my bedroom, so now I need something even bigger in the living room, which is where everybody gets together to watch. And, you know, today happens to be the first day of CES, virtual CES, and Samsung and LG both are talking about now getting into 80 plus inch sizes. So, you know, the 75 is now being downsized to, you know, the bigger ones. So I think we'll just continue seeing it getting bigger and bigger, and, you know.
Yeah, and within the next few years, video walls will allow for just about any configuration you want.
Yeah. I mean, Vizio's new P-Series Quantum, the flagship of that, is 85 inches. And it's $3,000. Who would have thought just a few years ago that you'd be buying a really good 85-inch screen for $3,000?
Yes,
so. I know. I sold one of the first 60-inch plasmas in this area. It was $20,000. Wow. It had 720p resolution, and I think it was about 6-plus inches thick.
Oh, and I bet it sounded like a bug zapper too.
you could tan your face while you were hanging it on the wall. It was a as an added bonus, you got a radiant heater. You
know? Yeah. I remember when my wife replaced our plasma TV in the media room, it's like the first thing we noticed was, geez, it's a lot quieter in here, you know, and a lot cooler. And that was only a 58 inch. So
this is the thing I've been bringing up with a bunch of people lately is, you know, because I started writing about this stuff when what were considered luxury home theaters first emerged, right? Mm-hmm. You could not pay somebody to sit in one of those rooms today, you know, with a Faruja doubler and a Runco projector and the source material, Laserdisc. It would be too offensive. You wouldn't last more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's weird to watch the evolution because, you know, working on shooting video, I cannot look at 720p video anymore. You know, somebody sends me a file like that, it's not acceptable for a cut. So things become the default quickly, and then your entire perception changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, even like, you know, the recent iPhone announced that it'll shoot video in Dolby Vision. I mean, think about that kind of capture quality has never been available to an end user. I mean, that they're going to put that, you know, professional video quality, the ability to make it in the hands of millions of people. So, I mean,
that's scary.
Yeah. But I mean, it's going to just, it's going to push the quality all the way down. If I'm used to shooting videos that look that good on my own, what more am I going to expect out of a $200 million experience?
We really need frolicking kittens in Dolby Vision.
My brain went in a completely different direction.
I can imagine.
We don't need that either, Dennis.
That's, and then not to play off of that, but, you know, and I know I'm in a tiny, tiny minority here, but there are very few things I actually want to see on a screen that big, you know, and it's become the default. And most of the material people are watching on it, are going to be watching on it, is not worthy of being seen at 75 inches or bigger.
Well, again, I think I think I'm on Siaka's side of this argument, in that it's not so much screen size as it is field of view. You know, does Cheers need to take up 45% of your field of view? You know, does I don't know, Friends need to be eating into your peripheral vision? And so it's really more about not necessarily the screen size as a single measure, it's screen size in relation to seating distance. And I get what you're saying, though. Yeah, for you know, I mean, I'm at 6.5 feet away from a 75-inch TV, and I feel that's kind of, I mean, you know, for the stuff that I watch, kind of optimum, because I get a good movie theater experience, but it's also not horrible for watching TV shows or whatever, the few that I watch. But yeah, I see what you're saying. It's I would not want to be watching cat videos on my TV. I guess.
Without getting into a philosophical thing about it, if you walk into your room and the people on the Weather Channel are bigger than you are, physically bigger than you are, yeah, that changes things.
It does.
You know, I do not want to watch any one of the news networks and have those people, you know, that big on a screen in front of me. It's going to feel way too much like Big Brother.
Yeah. Well, you know, it brings up an interesting thing. Most people can only have one display, right? I mean, the luxury of having a dual display system is beyond what most people can have.
You're talking about in the same room, in the same
space. In the same room, yeah. So, you know, if I want to enjoy a theatrical cinematic experience on the biggest screen possible, that's also going to mean watching the Weather Channel on the biggest screen possible.
Yeah,
which would be one thing. Like, you know, that's really why I like the ability to do multi-aspect on a projection screen, is that, you know, big cinematic things feel bigger and more cinematic, you know, and that's to go from 16:9 to 2:35 on a bigger surface. It is certainly more involving and immersive. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you have a 75-inch screen, everything you watch is going to be in 75 inches, yeah, whether it's a blockbuster movie or, you know, it's the nightly news.
Well, and also the other side of the equation is it's what is your target? What are you aiming for? Because the flip side of that coin is, if you're sort of basing your the relationship between your viewing distance and your screen, and you've only got one screen, if you're sort of targeting the nightly news or whatever, well, then you're selling short the cinematic experience at a time when TV shows are becoming more cinematic than ever. I mean, I'm thinking just an example of The Mandalorian. I mean, The Mandalorian is a television show that looks better than any movie that I can think of that was made more than 5 years ago. You know, it absolutely looks like a $200 million movie from 2015. You know what I mean? So one way or the other, something is going to be a compromised experience if you only have one screen, which is I think what you're saying, Siaka. So what's your target? What are you shooting for? What's the better experience, The Weather Channel or The Mandalorian? Or the, you know, latest Marvel movie or what have you.
I would put the cinematic experience above all of that. And, you know, but again, the reality of it is, if I have a traditional direct view TV, 50 inches, 100 inches, whatever, the Weather Channel is going to be bigger than The Mandalorian because of the aspect ratio.
That's valid.
It would be nice. And again, I know it'll never happen, but it would be nice if we could have a native 240 direct view panel so that people could enjoy, you know, bigger images.
You know, Vizio tried that a few years ago.
I know it'll never
hit 21:9 panels. Yeah.
It just, you know, the people don't want it, but I think that's still one of the areas where the front projection screen really, for the movie viewer, that's I think the biggest thing that it has to offer is an actually bigger experience when you're watching, you know, movies. And I've noticed that, you know, more and more of stream content, you know, Mandalorian, you know, pretty much anything, they're getting away from 16:9 because I think they want to not look like TV content. So, mm-hmm. But the result is it's a smaller image for most people watching it on their DirectView TV.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it is unfortunate that for the most part, the Weather Channel is a bigger image than the, you know, whatever movie or, you know, that you're watching. And I don't know, there's no solution to it unless you want to go to a front projector with a wide screen. It just is what it is.
Dennis, this is for both of you. We don't need to go there because I don't know what I'm getting myself into, but because we're talking about 4K and between the streaming services, because we now have a profusion of them, are there any qualitative differences you're seeing in what they're delivering?
Oh God!
Everybody says 4K, but who's got problems? Who has things to fix? Who's doing it right?
Yeah. Well, in terms of who's doing it really right, I think you have to give props to both Apple and Disney. Disney Plus and Apple TV are just, I mean.
Well, because you were saying with Nightmare Before Christmas, right? And Muppet Christmas Carol? Yeah.
Well, and those are two different things. The thing that surprised me about Muppet, I mean, about the Nightmare Before Christmas is that it is HD and it looks amazing in streaming. That's just not you. That's not a thing you could have said 2 years ago. I mean, streaming did not look good until 4K HDR came around. And I won't get into the technical reasons for that, but the very short reason is that HEVC, the codec that is used to compress this material, simply looks better with higher bitrate color and higher resolution. You know, when you give HEVC a 4K HDR image, it starts to not reveal a lot of the problems of low bitrate streaming. You don't see the banding, you don't see the black crush and things like that. So we've kind of come to expect that 4K HDR looks good. But at the same time, HD streaming has just never looked great. And yet Disney Plus has made it look great. It's kind of astounding. I own three different versions of The Nightmare Before Christmas on Blu-ray disc, and I was A-Bing with the Disney Plus stream, and there was no qualitative difference, which is just astounding. You can't say the same for, you know, Netflix. HD looks garbage on Netflix. It looks garbage on Amazon Plus, or Amazon, what is Amazon's?
Prime.
Thing? Amazon Prime. Sorry. Everything is Plus these days. I mean, it's... so that's the crazy thing. The crazy thing is that Disney Plus has made HD look good. But yeah, in terms of really, truly reference quality 4K HDR, yeah, Vudu looks great. Disney Plus looks great. Apple TV looks great. And then you've got a sort of tier under that, which is your Netflix, which is, you know, 90% perfect, let's say. And then you go step down from there into Amazon. So there's kind of a tiered list.
Okay, John, I will say when we I noticed, to me, Amazon is, you know, kind of Dennis said as well, they're the lowest quality.
Yeah.
when I'm watching Amazon, I notice the most artifacts. Mm-hmm. We were watching Alex Rider last night, and which is one of their newer shows, and I mean, just black crush and just banding and just noise, things that, you know, even not looking for them, it's like, wow, there, you know, there it is.
Yeah.
Two things I wanted to try to cover briefly is, last time we did a podcast right before Christmas, is there any Monday morning quarterbacking about what happened with Soul, Wonder Woman, any of the stuff that came out? Did that play out pretty much the way everybody expected?
I think on the last podcast, I said something about analysts predicting that Warner Brothers would need to double their paid subscriptions for this to be successful. And I want to say Warner announced something like a tripling of paid subscriptions. So it's still not a huge number, but it's significant enough that Warner feels that Wonder Woman 84 was a success for them.
To me, so many people get HBO Max for free because they were already subscribing. So, I mean, the bar of, I mean, if you had one paid subscriber and went to 10, it's a 10 times increase, but still you have 10, you know, so I'm not sure they've released how many paid subscribers they actually have or what it went up to, but the proof to me will be in, you know, a month from now when the 30 day, you know, has expired. If they got a million people to sign up at $7 a month, and those people all cancel in a month, making $7 million on Wonder Woman is not very good.
It's $16 a month.
I thought it was $6.95.
No.
Well, whatever. All right, $16 a month. So you made $16 million for a month. But still, I'm just wondering how many people, the retention is going to be the big thing. And I think, what does HBO Max have to offer? I think hopefully they're going to start doing things from their business model, like giving us Game of Thrones in 4K, Westworld in 4K, going back and starting to really fill in that other stuff. But so many people get it for free because they already subscribe to HBO. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, the other thing too is my business partner subscribed to HBO. The hoops that he had to go through, I know you've lamented this, Dennis, but the hoops that he had to go through to sign up for it, about halfway through, he's like, I don't even want to see this stupid movie anymore.
Yes, I know. It's their sign-up process and login process is just, it almost seems like farce.
Yeah.
It's that horrific.
I was helping a customer to add it to a TV, and it's like, okay, now we'll go to the phone. All right, now we're over to your computer. And it's like, you know, it was like everything it could do to shake us off the trail.
Yeah. Is your Blender connected to the internet perchance?
Yeah.
It's bad. Yes, we don't know how many paid subscriptions there are for HBO Max. All we know is that they said they tripled it, you know. So, but we you know, I think the last I heard, something like 60% of people who have free HBO Max accounts because of their cable package or their phone service or what have you just haven't even bothered to sign into the app. They for a while there, they couldn't even give it away for free.
Does anybody have a reading on Soul?
I haven't seen any.
We got Net Blase that something like that came out and nobody, you know, I'm talking about in general, you know, everybody was all about Milan and how well it did, but I think we're starting to get used to stuff being released this way.
Well, I think the difference is
people had to pay for it, you know?
Right. But there was the whole Soul versus Wonder Woman thing. So I would assume there would have been some attention on who fared better.
Yeah.
I think that they were both atop the streaming list for that week. And I think that Wonder Woman fell off more quickly than Soul. Certainly the critical reception of Soul has been far higher.
Hang on. I'm just Googling this now because I was curious. Yeah, Soul was the number one stream title. Whoa, 13% of viewers had subscribed to Disney Plus in order to watch Soul. Wow.
Now, this is surprising. You know, both of you have said that it's a very adult movie.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how Pixar manages to make stuff happen anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like my 4-year-old, she's like, I think I like it, but I don't really understand it. And it's like, you know, it's like that the colors are pretty. So it is definitely, I mean, it's not a family film, but, you know, not to say that in a negative way, it's really, it's a deep, high concept movie for not really meant in any way for little kids.
Yeah.
I just wonder if it comes down to Disney's just better at marketing.
Well, I think we have to accept that.
Yeah. I don't know. That was a rubber debate.
No, but you're talking about it as if it's inherent to the content of the films and that's got to do with how they performed. Whereas the performance numbers you're talking about may hinge almost solely on how well the films are marketed.
Yeah.
I just happened to think of this, but as a closing thing, is there any point in having the Oscars this year? What's been released? I mean, there have been no new releases this year. There's been really nothing that's excited anybody. I haven't seen anything I would consider a prestigious, serious film. I've seen a lot of crap dumped on the market. So should they even bother?
Boy, and
how do you in a year when there really aren't any theatrical releases, how does anybody qualify?
Yeah.
I was going to say of the things that came out, although it was last year because it was Christmas. If Soul got Best Picture, what a coup for Disney Pixar. I mean,
yeah, but it'd be by default.
Well, it's still a win there. Yeah. You know, a win is a win.
Well, I certainly didn't see a better new film in 2020. I'll say that, but yeah, it didn't have any theatrical release. So does it even qualify? Are they going to change the rules? I mean, who knows?
What made the thing is, it wasn't fair about what actually made it in the theaters or not. Everybody was performing triage and they sneaked things in when they could, but there was no consistency or logic to it, right?
Right.
So if that's not the level of entry, and then it's things on streaming, how do you keep everything from coming through the door? What's the cutoff point?
Mm-hmm.
I know nobody knows the answer to that, but, you know, the Oscars are considered a big deal, but I just don't see how they pertain this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Have there been any announcements? I don't follow it at all, but I mean, have there been announcements of nominees and things like that?
I haven't heard anything.
Well, yeah, just browsing the internet as quickly as I can. The only thing I'm seeing so far in terms of impacts is that they decided to consolidate the best sound mixing and best sound editing category into single best sound category.
Thank God for that.
Boy.
a bold step.
Bold move. Yeah.
Yeah, but last year around this time, you know, the candidates are starting to emerge, and it was probably the most interesting year for the Oscars in decades, right?
Mm-hmm.
A year later, we're looking at the exact opposite situation where neither one of us could name five films that deserved to even be considered.
Oh, this is interesting. Sorry to interject.
Yeah.
But guys, I just read that the this year's Academy Awards will be delayed for 2 months to April 25th, 2021. So that may be why we haven't heard any noise yet.
Are they going to have an adjustment for the time?
The eligibility period extends through February 28th. Yes.
Gotcha. It's still not very far off.
Well, there you go, Mike. They couldn't come up with a list either. So they're going to give it a couple more time.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking slightly more than a month, right? What are they going to get out and how are they going to get it out there? But I mean, California is in complete disarray. You're not going to see theaters open for eligibility.
It says here that the Academy issued a clarification of its eligibility criteria, stating that a week of nightly screenings at a drive-in theater would render films eligible for consideration.
Oh, great. Roger Corman is going to get an Oscar this year.
Yeah.
Man, I might shoot something and just rent out a theater. I could get an Oscar.
Oh, wow.
Well, but at least it'll give us something to talk about in a couple of months.
Sure. I'm voting for Soul.
All right. I'm not sure what to close with.
What about the thing you used to do, Mike? Do that thing.
What's that? Remind me.
Where you would like quizzes about cool stuff we've seen.
I don't think I was going to, but I don't think there is anything. Is there anything coming in the next couple of weeks anybody's looking forward to?
Oh, WandaVision this week. Oh my God. My tail is wagging so hard for WandaVision.
John, anything?
The Alabama football game tonight. I don't know. There's a two-part Tiger Woods documentary coming out on HBO Max. I mean, as a former golf pro, I'm interested in that. But I'm not quite as excited about Dennis for WandaVision. I'm curious about WandaVision, but I don't know that there's anything coming out that's really got me super excited. But I think I'm easier to please. I'm happy just to turn it on and find something and I'm entertained.
Mike, okay. How about you?
I'm scratching the bottom of catalog titles. Hmm. You know, these are the darkest days I've ever seen in the movies.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just nothing riveting. You know, there's a lot of stuff trying to pander, but there's nothing there trying to engage on any kind of significant level. And it's kind of depressing, you know? So we'll make it through somehow.
Yeah.
And I don't want to close on that. You guys say something more upbeat. I'm not there, you know?
Can I give a pitch for a show I really want people to watch?
Sure.
It's been on for a few years now, but it's a show on YouTube called Baumgartner Restoration. It is my security blanket right now. It is just one of the greatest shows. It's basically a private conservator who, you know, every few weeks walks you through the process of restoring a piece of art and they literally walks you through every step of the process. And it's very zen in that respect. It's there's a level of focus and attention in his work that to some degree lends it a very meditative quality. Every episode, I just like when it pops up in my newsfeed and YouTube, I get excited. And there are a few things in the world today that literally make me that happy excited. So if you would go check out Baumgartner Restoration in 4K on YouTube, that would make me happy.
Okay. John, do you have anything?
Well,
I'm sorry. I don't mean to put you on the spot because I can't answer my own question. So,
yeah, no, I mean, you know, kind of one that's gotten a lot of press. That's just a great nostalgic and it just to me seems to just show how you do a reboot just the right way is Cobra Kai. Loved Karate Kid in the 80s, and they have just done a fantastic job of fleshing out these characters and giving them interesting backstories and bringing back all of the old people from the show in a way that just expands on the universe. If you have any love for the 80s and saw the original and liked it at all, I think you'll love Cobra Kai. Season 3 is finished out on Netflix. And another one that my wife and I stumbled on that we really enjoyed, another Netflix title, is Alice in Borderland. a Japanese series, kind of Hunger Games like, where the first episode took a little bit of time to get into, but then it clips along right after that. You know, kind of interesting, this mystery of everyone who's disappeared in these games that the people are forced to play into, the you know, fight to the death. So those are a couple that we've, you know, been watching and enjoying lately. And Alice in Borderland, one of the risks of starting a new series seems to always be, you know, you get to the end and then, you know, they unceremoniously decide that's it, no, they're going to drop it. But it's already been, you know, picked up for a second series, so you won't be left out there hanging, which is, you know, kind of a safety blanket of knowing that, you know, you're going to get some more answers if you stick through it.
Okay, well, I think we're there. I think it's time to pull the plug on this puppy. Everybody good with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to stop recording.